Welcome to Celebrate Poe. And just to let you know, plans are to release this podcast every Monday night at 12 o'clock midnight. The musical intro to this podcast is from Edgar Allan Poe's favorite song, Come Rest in This Bosom. This series of episodes deals with several English writers who heavily influenced Poe, especially the English Romantic poets. And this is episode 52, Byron at the Movies. Or if you prefer, Swiss Monster Movies. All of the movies and television show in this episode are based on events that took place in Switzerland. And the movie production, the BBC production of Byron, will be covered in the next episode. Now, do you like movies? Sure, we all do. That sounds like a series of ads featuring Sally Struthers. Boy, that's an old reference. In a commercial for International Correspondence Schools. That's a bit of trivia. Sally Struthers, or Gloria on All in the Family, always began the ad by saying, "Do you want to earn more money? Sure, we all do." As a result, the line, "Sure, we all do," became a punchline itself. So, do you like movies? Sure, we all do. The first movie in this episode, about the 1816 literary competition at the Villa Diodati, is called Gothic, directed by frequently over-the-top director Ken Russell. Gothic takes place near Lake Geneva in Switzerland, but was shot in an old historic mansion in England. The movie has the usual plot, somewhat fictionalized, with Mary Godwin, her stepsister Claire Claremont, and Mary's future husband Percy Shelley staying for a while with Lord Byron and his physician friend, Dr. John Polidori. One June the 16th, they started playing a game of hide-and-seek. Later in the parlor, Percy Shelley talks about his interest in science. Now, this is in the movie. Polidori tells them about his interests in sleepwalking and nightmares. Not to be outdone, Lord Byron shows his guests Phantasmagoria, a book of horror stories he bought in Geneva. They read excerpts from the book and end up having a séance around a human skull. Claire then has what appears to be a seizure. The character of Lord Byron just stands there and smugly stares at Claire while she foams at the mouth and writhes on the floor. Mary, now remember, she is Claire's half-sister, describes them as Claire's horrors and recalls times during their childhood when unexplained events would occur around them, such as Claire's bed shaking for no apparent reason or doors slamming shut by themselves. Later, Lord Byron performs oral sex on Claire, during which she has a miscarriage. What a classy guy. And then Percy comes to smell an overpowering scent of decay and becomes more and more paranoid. Now let's jump to Mary at the bottom of a staircase. She hears a noise and feels liquid dripping on her. She naturally looks up and sees Dr. Polidori leaning over the banister, holding on to a bleeding wound on his neck. When the bleeding has lessened, the good doctor claims to have bitten by a vampire in his room. A Byron, always concerned about other people's feelings, not, accuses Dr. Polidori of self-inflicting the wounds. Percy begins ranting and raving, saying that the group gave birth to something during the séance. Polidori is scared of damnation for his homosexuality. Apparently, he actually was gay historically, but he also suffered from depression and was to eventually commit suicide. Now, at one point, Percy Shelley goes running and screaming and encounters Claire Claremont while he stares at her breasts. Oh, this is not any ordinary breast staring. Percy has taken laudanum and imagines Claire's nipples slowly change into really creepy eyes. But in my opinion, what should have come off as really scary is actually kind of funny. Mary then attempts to run out of the house and crashes through a glass door. Percy begins to believe that the presence haunting them is feeding off the group's fear. But wait, it gets better. Polidori tries to hang himself but fails. He sees a strange figure racing away from him on horseback. Byron and Percy feel that the best thing to do to banish any evil spirits is to recreate the seance. Meanwhile, in the basement, Claire is discovered nude and covered in mud. I mean, why not? Byron tries to hold the seance, but Mary refuses. And I can't imagine why. Mary tries to crush the skull that Byron attempts to use in the seance. I guess this was the skull from the previous seance. Mary then attempts to stab Byron with a shard. Percy stops her, and Percy and Shelley began kissing passionately. By now, their kissing doesn't come across as shocking or strange, but more of a ho-hum, why not? Mary flees through the home and sees a vision of her son William in a coffin. I know in life Mary had suffered a miscarriage, but showing a vision of her son in a coffin strikes me as a bit much. In the movie, Mary tries to throw herself off the balcony, but is stopped by Percy. She wakes up the next morning to join Byron, Percy, and Claire in the garden. Many historians and journalists have suggested that the events of the literary competition that was to inspire Mary Shelley's Frankenstein and Polidori's The Vampire were triggered by the group's use of opium during their vacation together. Discussing the film's basis in reality, the actor Julian Sands, who played Shelley, later commented, "I think these portraits are rooted in reality. If people think otherwise, it's because of the later Victorian whitewash of them. They were not simply beautiful romantic poets. They were subversive, anarchic hedonists pursuing a particular line of amorality. The film portrays Lord Byron as demonic and Shelley as on the verge of madness, but the film is an expressionist piece, and that's not an unreasonable expression of their realities." Okay, whatever. If you watch the movie, you might be left with the impression that Mary Shelley's Frankenstein was inspired by the loss of her child. But film historian Robert Shale retorts that idea by writing that Gothic's Baroque visuals can't disguise the dubious nature of Ken Russell's premise that the book was inspired by the author's loss of a baby. Now, at one time in the movie, Lord Byron looks down on a dark floor and sees the head of a roast pig. Then he looks at the hog's head on the floor again, and it's the head of Polidori. Then he looks down, and it's a pig again. What's going on? And ultimately, I mean, who cares? I guess the movie's greatest claim to fame is that it was one of the earliest roles of the late Natasha Richardson of the Richardson/Redgrave family. Her mother was Vanessa Redgrave, one of the greatest actresses alive. Vanessa Redgrave also played Lady Melbourne in the vastly superior Byron, another movie about Lord Byron that this podcast will review in the next episode. Now, getting back to Gothic, the movie Gothic ends with modern-day tourists visiting the villa. A voiceover announces that Mary's son, William, died 3 years later. Percy drowned in 1822. Mary Shelley died at the age of 53. And Claire died a spinster at the age of 81. This movie does have its share of over-the-top visuals. Some were hallucinatory. Some were confusing, and some seemed completely unmotivated, which I can kind of deal with. Even though I wanted to like the movie, it got to the point that I just didn't care what the actors were doing or what happened. Instead of watching the screen, I kept looking at the timer and hoped the movie would end soon. Gothic is less than an hour and a half, but it seemed like it lasted forever. I know this almost makes it sound like I don't like anything, but the movies regarding that weekend, as well as the monsters invented in the literary competition of 1816, get much better. Now, the next movie is Haunted Summer, or as Poe might say in a Richmond accent, Haunted Summer, from 1988. And it covers pretty much the same material, but is a far superior movie. The movie has Laura Dern from the original Jurassic Park as Claire Claremont. The movie has a beautiful look. Even its outdoor scenes look like muted paintings of the period. To start with, the conversations are far more realistic than those in Gothic. You could easily imagine a group of people, such as those in Haunted Summer, sitting around talking about science, literature, philosophy, and other subjects while they party. And the character portraying Lord Byron, Philip Anglim, comes across as a real person who can be charming while also being insulting. And the character of Dr. Polidori is extremely sympathetic. In Gothic, Dr. Polidori is irritating. In contrast to the frequently cheesy segments of Gothic, Haunted Summer has some extremely powerful lines. Because the characters are more fully developed, they come across as human beings with feelings. In a highly memorable scene, Lord Byron, Shelley, Mary, Claire, and a jealous Dr. Polidori are floating in a boat across Lake Geneva with Shelley and Lord Byron reciting some of their greatest works. It makes you stop and realize Shelley and Byron really were great writers. Shelley and Byron also casually talk about their political philosophies and worldviews, a lot more interesting than it might sound. Though apparently Gothic and Haunted Summer have fictionalized aspects, the elements of Haunted Summer seem to be far more historically accurate. The scary parts in Haunted Summer are there not just for shock value, and they're far more logical. They creep up on you slowly, which makes them all the more creepy. I don't think I ever looked at the timer to see how much was left in the movie while it was playing. It was that interesting. And I just might watch Haunted Summer again. The last full movie, I'll get to a television episode later on the list for today, that was set in the Villa Diodati, is a 1988 Spanish movie written and directed by Gonzalo Suarez. The movie won several Goya Awards in Spain. Translated into English, the movie is called Rowing with the Wind. It's an odd title, but again, it's Rowing with the Wind. Now, first, when I began this podcast, I resolved to try and watch any movie that I would review, to do that just as much as humanly possible. But the Indianapolis Library did not have Rowing with the Wind, though they did have Gothic and The Haunted Summer, both in DVD format and online. And I wasn't about to request the library ask that they buy Rowing with the Wind because I didn't know how long it would take to come in or even if it was available, but mainly because I didn't want to, shall we say, overstay my welcome and become burdensome by requesting too many titles that nobody was interested in. And the lowest price on Amazon was roughly $30 for a movie less than 90 minutes. I had to stop and take stock of the fact that I've been spending way too much money for books about Edgar Allan Poe. And to be honest, I didn't exactly relish the idea of watching another movie about the Villa Diodati. But I thought I would include it in this episode, at least a mention of the movie, to be more comprehensive. The movie not only covers the literary competition where Mary Shelley came up with the idea for her novel Frankenstein, but apparently deals with Mary imagining the monster becoming real. A great deal of tragedy occurs regarding those around her, and she sees the creature of her imagination as the cause. Though on the Well, definitely on the positive side, the movie seems to have gotten very good reviews on Amazon and does have Elizabeth Hurley in her second movie as Claire Claiborne. Lord Byron is played by, now get ready for this, by none other than a young Hugh Grant. He would be perfect for the role, alternately snobbish, flirtatious, serious, childlike, seductive. At least that's how he came across in the excerpts online. And he comes across as perfect for the part. Hugh Grant as Lord Byron can clearly communicate emotions by just moving an eye or the corner of his mouth. In the show notes, I put a link to a YouTube video of an excerpt from Running with the Wind, just to let you know it's out there. And just from a few clips of the movie, I suspect that it is a lot closer in tone to Haunted Summer, good, than Gothic, a mess. Maybe I will order Rowing with the Wind someday, but right now I decided to put a personal moratorium on ordering more books and movies. Though after looking at the excerpt on YouTube, I just might... No, George, you don't need any more. You don't need any more movies or books. Well, anyway, I think I'll go back and rewatch Hugh Grant in the British romantic drama Morris from the Library. Morris was filmed in the 1980s, and in it, a young Hugh Grant plays a student at Cambridge who has a gay lover at the school, just like Lord Byron did at Cambridge. Well, actually, Lord Byron had several lovers, and the culture for gay people was even worse then, if that can be imagined. Morris, some people might say Maurice, is beautifully filmed with great acting, and in my opinion, is one of the best movies regarding gay issues ever made. But when it comes to recent depictions of the events at the Velo Diodati, I'll take Doctor Who. Speaking of Doctor Who, and how's that for a planned segue? Well, let me say something first here. I'm using voice control on my computer. I'm using that now and have dictation on. Sometimes I'll read back to myself what I've typed to see how it sounds or if it makes any sense. And if I don't turn off dictation by saying go to sleep, then voice dictation types back my verbal musings. I'll say, for example, don't type that. I'm just thinking aloud. And voice control types, don't type that. I'm just thinking aloud. Anyway, getting back to Doctor Who. The episode is called The Haunting of the Villa Diodati. First, a little deviation here I think is necessary. I'll get back to the episode eventually. In doing this podcast, I decided to not use audio clips. Definitely, if I had questions about them being in the public domain. Buzzsprout warns against using audio clips, and there's just too much danger in using an audio clip to which you just don't have the rights. That can be tricky. And of course, if I ever wanted to do anything commercial with this podcast, then a lawyer could make the argument that that clip from Disney, for example, was being used by me for commercial purposes. Supposedly, Disney has even sued nursing homes for showing Disney videos. So I wouldn't depend on the goodness of their hearts where money is involved. After all, Disney is a business, a huge business. And again, I'm just using Disney as an example. One could use the fair use argument, but that doesn't mean you can't be taken to court. Oh, there's a good chance you would win, but who wants that kind of expense? Now, I have used clips in the public domain in this podcast, such as the voice of Edwin Booth, which is from the 19th century. Some say media from before 1923 are okay to use in the United States. Other countries say 100 years after the death of the author. And some say 70 years after the death of the author. And since almost anything on the internet ends up going international, I would use the 100 years after the death of the author rule. Of course, there are those sticky rules where the famous ancestor's descendants own the rights to his or her works. But anything by Poe or the Romantic poets should be okay to use. And another great source is the United States government. For example, in episode 26, I used a section, a rather lengthy section, from a speech by then-President Clinton, as well as words by Dr. Francis Collins, head of the National Institutes of Health, or NIH, and he's also Anthony Fauci's boss. The NIH is considered a part of the United States Department of Health and Human Services, and as such, Dr. Collins is a government employee. In other words, his words in that speech are in the public domain. You know, it might be interesting to go back and listen to that speech because at the time, COVID was extremely widespread, and Dr. Collins was one of those who was working night and day in trying to develop a vaccine. Remember, this was before a vaccine was developed. Now, I know there are very good podcasts out there that do use current music and spoken audio clips under the Fair Use Clause, but I don't want to risk it. Being taken to court is just not worth it. In any case, they say it is better to contact a lawyer. I know that might be inexpensive, but it is better than being sued. Now, finally, yes, finally, back to Doctor Who. The Doctor Who episode is number 8 from season 12 and appropriately begins with Thunder and Lightning. I've watched it several times. It seems that each time I see something new. And the BBC must realize they have quite a fan base because there are several transcripts of Doctor Who episodes on the web. All, of course, say they are for education and entertainment purposes only. Still, I use an online script of the shows to keep my bearings, and that's just something I do for myself. And I try to stick to using exact phrases that Byron and Shelley used in the 19th century in this case, again making them public domain. Now back to Doctor Who. The episode begins appropriately enough with Thunder and Lightning, and a character whom we later learn is Lord Byron saying, "I've never known air as dank and frigid." Lord Byron then asks if anyone would like to hear a ghost story, and what would they like to hear? The character of Mary Shelley replies, "Something to awaken thrilling horror, to make us dread to look around, to curdle the blood and quicken the beatings of the heart." They hear insistent knocking at the door, and finally Byron says that they have nothing to be afraid of and open the door. The 13th Doctor, Graham O'Brien, Ryan Sinclair, and Yasmin Khan are outside in the pouring rain and screaming in terror at the people inside. At the same time, the characters of Byron, Shelley, Polidori, Mary, and Claire are inside the Villa Diodati, also screaming, but at the people outside. In a clever little bit of stagecraft, the Doctor holds out the psychic paper in the form of a calling card. Now, in case you're not a Doctor Who fan, a psychic paper is a blank white card with special properties. When shown to someone, that person can only see whatever the Doctor wanted them to see written on it. By the way, it's not 100% foolproof. A psychic paper, for example, did not work at all in a Doctor Who episode involving William Shakespeare. He was just too much of a genius. And I doubt that it would have worked on Edgar Allan Poe, but I digress. The clever thing in the Villa Diodati episode is that the psychic paper does not work. The Doctor routinely holds it out, realizes it's not working, and says that it might need to be blow-dried with all the rain falling. Something very, very strange really is happening within the house. You see, the Doctor is taking Graham, Ryan, and Yaz back in time to 1816 to Lake Geneva to be there while Mary Shelley is inspired to write Frankenstein, though she warns the group not to say anything about Frankenstein. I guess she didn't want to interfere with history. Not surprisingly, Lord Byron suggests that they each write a horrifying ghost story. Percy is soon missing. That wasn't supposed to happen, and he leaves strange marks on the walls of his room. strange events start occurring, such as furniture and paintings moving. Lord Byron suggests that it's just a ghost, but the doctor becomes more and more suspicious. The group sees a supernatural figure that Doctor Who recognizes as something moving through time. It then manifests itself as a half-converted Cyberman. Doctor Who goes off to confront the Cyberman, who was sent back in time to look for the Cyberium. And no, the Cyberium is not a person, but a liquid metal with the collective knowledge of the Cybermen. Cybermen, that's plural. The Doctor and the Villa Diodati group find Percy Shelley hiding in the cellar. The Doctor finds out that Shelley is possessed by the Cyberium. Remember, that's the liquid metal with the collective knowledge of the Cybermen. And you see this in a flashback of Shelley reaching into what was probably Lake Geneva. The Doctor then tricks the Cyberium into leaving Shelley's body. The Doctor and her companions then leave for the future. There are quite a few twists and turns in the plot, and I don't want to spoil it for you if you haven't seen the episode. You can tell I really get into it. At one point, Lord Byron quotes, "She walks in beauty like the night." The Doctor then continues the poem, "Of cloudless climes and starry skies." And Lord Byron replies with, "I'm intensely flattered that you're familiar with my work." At another point, the Cyberman character quotes from Queen Mab, Book 2, "There's not one atom of yon earth but once living man." In episode 47, "Can Spring Be Far Behind?" I briefly discussed Queen Mab and pointed out that this is not the Queen Mab of Shakespeare, the fairy queen who flies over sleepers and gives birth to their dreams. Percy Shelley used a far more complex description of Queen Mab. Shelley portrayed the fairy queen in a political epic in which Queen Mab enters a time and space journey to reveal the ideal nature of humanity's potential, what humankind should and can be. In sentiments that could have come right out of Edgar Allan Poe, the Doctor gives an impassioned speech regarding Shelley. She emphasizes that words matter and are an essential part of our existence as humans. The haunting of the Villa Diodati ends with Lord Byron reading these 12 lines to a seated audience from his poem Darkness. "The world was void. The populous and the powerful was a lump. Seasonless, herbless, treeless, manless, lifeless, a lump of death, a chaos of hard clay. Ships sailorless lay rotting on the sea, and their masts fell down piecemeal as they drooped. They slept on the abyss without a surge. The waves were dead, the tides were in their grave. The moon, their mistress, had expired before. The winds were withered in the stagnant air, and the clouds perished. Darkness had no need of aid from them. She was the universe." Many scholars have claimed that the Romantic writers, especially Lord Byron, were the first full-fledged ecological writers in the Western literary tradition. In Darkness and Climate Change, an article by Scott Becker in the Romantic Poets blog of Hamilton College, the poem Darkness is a dreamlike vision of the end of days. In his poem, Lord Byron describes man burning its civilizations in an attempt just to survive. "We are gluttonously consuming resources today and at the same time extinguishing any hope of long-term happiness just to make our lives a little bit more convenient." Mr. Becker writes that he doubts that this is a mainstream interpretation, one that probably wasn't as true in 1816, but unfortunately is becoming more and more of a reality. I think that this episode of Doctor Who conveys the spirit and sensibility of the Villa Diodati to the point that it should be included with strictly so-called historical accounts. After all, we were not there. We may know the results, but not exactly sure what was said. The haunting of the Villa Diodati, the Doctor Who episode of that, does a very good job of depicting what it must have been like. Now, today the technology is so advanced in this episode of Doctor Who, and with the Gothic-like sets and lighting taking your breath away, obviously the sets involving, or the events involving Doctor Who and her fellow time travelers are purely fictional, but are set against the lives of some very progressive and creative historical figures. And that makes those historical characters seem more alive. The constant interplay of the futuristic characters and individuals from the past brings out the basic human qualities of both, a characteristic of the best examples of time travel stories. In conclusion, I'd like to say a little bit about the structure of this podcast. Yes, there is one, but it doesn't always come across as well as I would like it. When I first came up with the idea of doing a podcast about Poe, I considered time travel, that I would somehow go back in time to have the character of Poe speak about his life and circumstances. There are already many excellent examples of outstanding time travel literature. For example, in Rip Van Winkle by Washington Irving, one of Poe's contemporaries. Here the hero falls asleep on a mountain and wakes up 20 years later. He realizes he's been forgotten. His wife has died, and his daughter is no longer a child. And in A Christmas Carol, Ebenezer Scrooge is haunted by the ghost of his former business partner. The second ghost may be in the present, but the first and third ghosts take him to the past and future, respectively. A Christmas Carol is perhaps the most popular time travel story ever written, although most people don't think of it that way. The content and style are handled so masterfully that the contrast between periods is handled seamlessly. The events seem to all blend together to make Scrooge the miser that he has become at the beginning of the story. Views of the past show why, and a view of the future shows what he may become. In the classic novel Slaughterhouse-Five, Indianapolis native Kurt Vonnegut wrote a novel about a man who randomly travels through time, jumping from one era to another without apparent order. Like many of Poe's works, such as The Black Cat and especially The Telltale Heart, Vonnegut's story is told by an unreliable narrator who may not be very credible. Slaughterhouse-Five begins the novel with, "All of this happened, more or less." The narrator has been a university student and newspaper reporter, and he writes about a man named Billy Pilgrim who believes that he was held in an alien zoo and has frequently traveled through time. The novel ends with an eloquent anti-war message, using time travel and short, often repetitious sentences to express complex ideas. In Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban by J.L. Rowling, one of the characters has a huge course load at Hogwarts, so she uses what is called a time turner to help her do all the work. In the novel 11-22-63 by Stephen King, a man travels through a time portal in an attempt to go back into the past and prevent the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And even Edgar Allan Poe wrote a lesser-known short story involving time travel that this podcast will discuss in detail later. The story, A Tale of the Ragged Mountains, is the only work that Poe wrote with the state of Virginia as a background. A Tale of the Ragged Mountains has a hero who claims to have been transported back to the 1780s, But typical of Poe, by the end of the story, you're not so sure. There are so many others. Time travel is a very popular genre. And I've always gone out of my way personally to read books and see movies about time travel. So when I first thought about how to organize Celebrate Poe, I thought time travel might be a natural for the podcast. I read a semi-interesting book called In Bed with Lord Byron. I definitely would not call it great literature, where a girl goes back in time to fall in love with Mr. Mad, Bad, and Dangerous to Know. But it just didn't cut it for me. I admire Doctor Who, but the show, and now franchise, has a tremendous amount of resources to work with. BBC money and talent, incredibly, incredibly wonderful actors such as David Tennant. Okay, if you're a Doctor Who fan, you probably have your own favorite actor. But the fact is that it seems everyone associated with Doctor Who does some pretty good stuff. In other words, my trying to use time travel as a vehicle ended up causing too many problems. Mainly, it just didn't flow or seem convincing. Now, when I was living in West Virginia and traveling around the state as Poe for the Humanities Council, I was working as a guide at Falling Water in Pennsylvania, about an hour away by car from Morgantown, where I lived. But that didn't seem so far when I thought about the three-hour-plus commutes to Washington, D.C. that some people who live outside the Beltway have. Also, Falling Water was in a rural area, and getting to it was a beautiful drive. Now, stick with me from what I've been saying here. There's a point to all this. Anyway, I ended up doing a one-man stage show that I wouldn't have been able to do if I didn't have contact with some of the people at Falling Water. This was in a huge old-fashioned theater about 100 years old near Falling Water. I called the play Celebrate Poe and was the ghost of Poe. This way, I could talk about events that occurred after Poe's death and subjects that he might not have discussed, such as his writing style, comparisons with modern authors, and films and musics based on his life and works. So when I was racking my brain trying to come up with the format for a podcast, I realized I already had it. It was right there in front of me. Just do a detailed extension of Celebrate Poe. That's going to be a lot of work. Instead of a 90-minute show, I had enough material for hundreds of hours, and dividing the information up lent itself far more to a podcast. So I came up with the idea of the ghost of Mr. Poe coming to me and talking about his life. I would use mainly primary sources or weave information by Poe scholars in and out of the narrative. And I thought it was very nice that Mr. Poe invited Mr. Dickens and Mr. Shakespeare to also be guest ghosts in the future. The ghost format also allowed me to express my opinions and tell personal stories that hopefully are relevant when the ghosts aren't there. So thanks for listening to Celebrate Poe, and join me on our journey as we delve even deeper into learning more about America's Shakespeare, with a few surprises. Now, sources for this episode include the motion pictures Gothic and Haunted Summer and The Haunting of the Villa Diodati, a television episode from the 12th season of the BBC's Doctor Who, as well as the complete works of Percy Bysshe Shelley by Percy Shelley, the complete works of George Gordon Lord Byron by Lord Byron, and Darkness and Climate Change by Scott Becker from the Romantic Poets, a blog of Hamilton College. Why not visit my podcast website at celebratepoe.buzzsprout.com. Click on the episode you want to learn more about to see its show notes and a transcript. The next episode is called Shelley at the Movies. I plan to deal with the excellent Mary Shelley biopic, a wonderful movie that includes Mary's relationship with Percy Shelley, the time at the Villa Diodati, and her publication of Frankenstein. And I didn't have time to get to all the Byron-related movies in this episode, so I'm going to review the excellent BBC two-parter of Byron. And then I would like to end with a review of an awesome British stage production of Frankenstein. Thank you for listening to Celebrate Poe.